following the death of Yasser Arafat, who was for more than 40 years the recognized leader of the Palestinian national movement and a symbol for people, both supporters of Palestinian rights and opponents. There is a lot of discussion in the media and from politicians, particularly in the United States, in Canada, in the European Union, saying that we have a window of opportunity, a moment of opportunity to advance the peace process. And in January, elections are scheduled in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip for a new leader of the Palestinian Authority. What's missing from the discussion, and I think what is fundamental to understand at the present time, is that nothing has changed with the death of Yasser Arafat that makes an end to the conflict more likely. Why? Because all of the basic factors which make conflict between Israelis and Palestinians inevitable still exist. In Israel, the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip today, there are approximately 10 million people living. About half of them are Israeli Jews, and the other half are Palestinians. Now, you can take any two groups of people. They don't have to be Israelis and Palestinians. You can call them Group A and Group B. When one group in a country has a total monopoly on military, economic, and political power, and the other group lacks even citizenship, basic rights, any control over their day-to-day life, then conflict is inevitable. And the situation we have in Israel-Palestine is one of near total domination by Israel and near total disenfranchisement of the Palestinians. In East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza Strip, you still have, excuse me, millions of Palestinians living under Israeli military occupation. Every aspect of their life is controlled by the Israeli army. What does that mean? If we imagine what it would mean in Montreal, it's very hard for us to conceive of what it would mean. It means that if you leave your house to go down to the supermarket to buy some milk or a packet of cigarettes, you're risking your life because there might be tanks in the street, there might be soldiers, there might be a patrol. It means that you don't know if tomorrow you can get to the university because there might be roadblocks, there might be a curfew. If you have family members or friends who live on the other side of the city, you might not be able to see them for days, months, years, depending on the situation. Now imagine that a foreign army, say the United States Army, invades Montreal, and they build a wall down the middle of the city. Maybe they will build a wall down the middle of Rue Sainte-Catherine. What would it mean to you if you can now never cross from one side of Montreal to the other? Just take a moment to think about it. It's unimaginable because you take it for granted every day. And I take that same freedom for granted in Chicago, where I live. But that's something that Palestinians live without the basic freedom to live in their own houses, their own streets, their own cities, their own towns, unmolested by a foreign army. The situation we have today has been in production for a very long time. The conflict, you know, often I talk about this, particularly in the United States, and people say, oh, these people have been fighting for thousands of years and there's no hope. They haven't been fighting for thousands of years. This is a conflict which is about one century old, 100 years old. And it's a long time. It's more than most of us live, but it's not thousands of years old. It's not a religious conflict, although it has religious elements to it. It is a political conflict. It's a conflict about power, about human rights, about citizenship. The problem that Israel is facing today is that it is rapidly becoming a situation similar to what existed in apartheid South Africa. As I mentioned, now today the population ruled by Israel is 50-50, 50% Palestinian, 50% Israeli Jews. Soon, very soon, within 5 or 10 years at the maximum, Palestinians will be a majority as they were in the past before Israel was created and before most of them were expelled from the country. Why? Because the birth rate of Palestinians is much higher. They have much larger families. And Israelis have much lower fertility rate. And Israelis are emigrating at a higher rate. Israelis are leaving the country very fast. So in such a situation, there are only three options for a resolution. The option which Israel, which the international community agreed by consensus, was that there would be a division of the country into two states, a state for the Palestinians and a state for Israel. So far, all efforts to produce a two-state solution have failed. Now, I want to talk about that more in a few minutes, but I want to address some of the arguments we get from the Israeli government first. When you listen to any official Israeli explanation for why we have no peace, they say because of the Palestinians, because they use violence, they use terrorism, and if only they stop the terrorism and the violence, then there will be peace. The problem with this argument is it ignores the fact that Israel maintains its military occupation only with the use of violence. But violence, which wears a uniform and which has a flag, is called a state. It's called self-defense. It's called an army. Violence by people who don't have a state is called terrorism. But the effect of the violence is the same. You have innocent Israeli civilians who are killed by Palestinians, and certainly we should condemn any act which targets innocent civilians, whether they're Israeli or Palestinian. But from any moment of time you measure, the number of Palestinians killed by the Israeli army is always greater than the number of Israelis killed by Palestinians. And to give you the most recent statistics, in the month of October, the Israeli army killed 165 Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Most of them were unarmed civilians, many of them killed in their houses, in their streets. 36 of them were children. That's more than one child every day. And if you take the proportion, the population of all of Canada together is 32 million. If you were to make it proportionate, it would be the equivalent of about 1,700 Canadians killed in a month. And that's typical. And in the same month of October, no Israeli civilians were killed by Palestinians in Israel. And in the occupied territories, three Israeli soldiers were killed and one Israeli colonist, one Israeli settler. So why do we hear always condemnation of Palestinian violence? I think we now are in a new situation in the world where the right to defend yourself is reserved only for the strong. Weak people, people who are fighting to defend their homes and their land have no right anymore, even though the right to resistance is recognized in international law. If you read the Constitution of Sweden, this is the country which is often held up as an example of enlightenment and democracy and human rights. The Constitution of Sweden gives every Swedish person the obligation to participate in resistance if Sweden falls under foreign military occupation. So this is not a principle that is in any way new. I want to show you a few maps which illustrate the situation in terms of why it has been impossible to have a two-state solution. This map is a general map of the region. It shows you Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip together. When Israel was created, before Israel was created, this entire region had a population of almost 2 million people. This was in 1947-48. And two-thirds of that population, 66%, were Palestinian Arabs, Muslims and Christians. An absolute majority of the population were Palestinians. And one-third of the country were Jewish immigrants. Most of them arrived very recently in the country. There was always a Jewish community that existed in Palestine, a small Jewish community which was integrated into the country. These were Palestinian Jews. Many of them were ethnically Arab. They spoke Arabic. Some of them came from Europe, but not with a political motive, with a religious motive to be close to what they consider a holy land. In 1947, you have to excuse me while I locate the map. I think it's it's okay, we won't look at that map. I will show you the more recent maps. The basis of the two-state solution. It's hard to see. There we go. What happened in 1948 when Israel was created is that three-quarters of the Palestinian population were expelled or forced to flee their homeland. In the area that became Israel, the white area, more than 500 Palestinian towns, cities, and villages were destroyed, and three-quarters of the population were forced out into Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and into the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And in a short period of time, a few months, a country which had a majority Palestinians Palestinians became a minority in their own country, and most of the population became refugees. The situation remained like that till 1967, and then Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and then another wave of refugees was created, and many more Palestinians were pushed into Jordan. Since that time, there was a strong, since the beginning, there was a strong Palestinian movement of resistance and liberation. The origin of the conflict, the reason I'm going into this history, is because I think it's crucial to understand that the origin of the conflict is the expulsion of the Palestinian people and the transformation of the majority of Palestinians into refugees. And the root of the Palestinian national movement was the return of Palestinian refugees to their homes, to their country. And this is understandable. It was not the creation of a Palestinian state. Only after 1967, the idea of a Palestinian state was raised as a compromise, that Israel exists, we can't do anything about it, we have to accept something less. So Palestinians accepted, as a compromise, the idea of a state in just the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which is 22% of Palestine. This was an enormous historic compromise. It's unprecedented. I can't think of any other situation where a people willingly offered 78% of their country to a colonist state, a settler state, which arrived. The problem is, since 1967, Israel has been building colonies, settlements, in the West Bank at a very high rate. This map, which just focuses on the West Bank here, all of these blue triangles show you Israeli settlements, colonies in the West Bank. Israel built the colonies with the specific goal, which they stated openly, which is to prevent ever an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and to prevent the creation of a Palestinian state. They did it in such a way, as you see, the pattern of the settlements is designed to break Palestinians, to surround them. If you look, follow the blue line. Nablus is here. Nablus is surrounded by Israeli settlements. Jerusalem, which is the center of Palestine, culturally, religiously, socially, artistically, is completely surrounded by Israeli settlements. Hebron, surrounded by Israeli settlements. The Jordan Valley, and so on. The settlements were built in a strategic way. The problem now is that you have more than 400,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. 400,000 living among 3.5 million Palestinians. And the infrastructure which Israel has built is built in a way that completely makes any notion of a Palestinian state extremely difficult to imagine. This map, which is very complicated to look at, but the important thing to understand about it is that the areas surrounded here are completely surrounded by Israel and cut off. And Israel is building a system of walls, cutting off the Palestinians in giant ghettos. How can we describe this situation today? I want to just put that map. This map. If we listen to the words of South African law professor John Dugard, who is the special rapporteur for human rights in the Palestinian territories at the United Nations. He wrote in a report, in an official report, that Israel has created an apartheid regime in the occupied territories worse than that which existed in South Africa. And he is in a good position to make such a judgment because he was a member of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was created in apartheid South Africa after the fall of apartheid. And he understands well the atrocities that were committed by the apartheid regime. Now, you would imagine that the international community would take seriously its obligations under international law. What did they say? They say that the Israeli military occupation is illegal. There are many resolutions of the Security Council which say that the entire regime of settlements is illegal. In July, the International Court of Justice in The Hague ruled very clearly that the walls which Israel is building are illegal and should be dismantled. And it called upon all members of the United Nations to work to prevent Israel from building the wall and to actually dismantle it. But the conception which is dominating now in the public discussion and in international diplomacy is a completely different one. The United States is the only country with the power by itself to have a decisive influence on Israel. Without U.S. military, economic, and diplomatic support, Israel could not afford to maintain the occupation regime against the Palestinians. And even with billions of dollars of U.S. support, the occupation is draining Israel. As I mentioned, 850,000 Israelis have already left the country. Israel's economy is collapsing. Unemployment is over 10%. There are severe cuts in social welfare, in social support, and in basic programs for Israelis because of the economic cost of the occupation. But the United States has absolutely failed to put pressure on Israel, and this is a factor. This is mainly due to Israel's role in American domestic politics. Israel is really not a foreign policy issue in the United States. It's a domestic issue in elections. And that's something which we're starting to see in Canada as well. A shift has occurred in U.S. policy. In the past, the United States used to talk about UN resolutions, used to talk about Israeli withdrawal, and now there's a new rhetoric. After he won re-election, President Bush held a press conference with the British Prime Minister Tony Blair. And of course, there was a lot of talk about this new opportunity after Yasser Arafat died. And one journalist asked Mr. Bush, okay, so let's make this opportunity real. Are you going to ask Israel to stop building more colonies in the West Bank? This is basic if we want to have peace negotiations. I mean, if we take a very simple example, if instead of talking about something complicated like a country, let's talk about a pizza. If you and I want to decide how to cut, to slice a pizza, to see who's more hungry, who paid more for the pizza, who likes olives, who likes anchovies, and we say we have 10 minutes to negotiate where to cut the pizza before the pizza gets cold. And we start negotiating. And while we're negotiating, I start grabbing the pizza and eating it as fast as I can. And you're sitting on the other side of the table. What will you do? You can sit there and keep talking and pretend nothing is happening, in which case the pizza will disappear very fast. You can go and appeal to other people and say, look, he's eating the pizza, stop him. You know, come and help me, support me. Help me win my right to the pizza. Or you can fight back. And the Palestinians have tried all of these things. It's astonishing to me that the Palestinians are lectured constantly by the international community. You must use peaceful means, you must use law, you must do all of these things. Well, when they went to the International Court of Justice in The Hague, I can't imagine a more peaceful course of action. Most of the so-called civilized democratic countries opposed that. They opposed the Palestinians going to the International Court. We're told Palestinians should use nonviolence. I support nonviolence and I'm against violence. Every day there's nonviolence in Palestine. Very fierce nonviolent resistance. When Israel builds a wall to stop people getting to their land to collect their harvest and their olives, and people climb over the wall or go around it or dig a tunnel under it to reach their fields, that's nonviolent resistance. When Israel closes schools or prevents children reaching schools and people reach the schools, that's nonviolent resistance. When Israel demolishes your house and your neighbors give you shelter in their house and they help you to rebuild your house, that's nonviolent resistance. And this happens every day millions of times. But nobody in the United Nations or in the White House ever said, look, the Palestinians are having a strike. They're rebuilding their houses. Quick, we have to have a summit, a peace summit, because the Palestinians are resisting nonviolently. The only time there's attention to the Middle East is when there's violence. And of course, more when Israelis are being killed. As I mentioned, in October and November, the number of Palestinians killed by Israel exceeds 200. In October, it was 165. Until now, from the beginning of October, it's more than 200. This morning, the New York Times newspaper, on the editorial page, has an editorial in which it talks about the recent lull in violence, the recent calm. What does that mean, a calm or a lull in violence? It means only Palestinians are being killed, because no Israelis have been killed in the past month or two, or very few. The New York Times says there's no violence, even though more than 200 Palestinians, more than 40 children have been killed in this period of quiet. So what message does that send? If you want to get attention, you must use violence. The same people who preach nonviolence and diplomacy are the same ones who only react when there's violence and only use violence, because we see in Iraq how the United States relies on negotiations and nonviolence. We see how much the United States practices what it preaches to the Palestinians. Now, we hear a lot of talk about the roadmap. This is supposedly a peace plan which is supposed to bring a process which will lead to peace. And the sponsors of this process is something called the Quartet, which is made up of the United States, the European Union, Russia, and that's four, right? I'm losing count because my mind is starting to shut down after speaking for so many times. The quartet has refused absolutely to fulfill its basic functions, one of which would be the protection of the Palestinians. Last June, Israel destroyed the homes of more than 3,000 Palestinians in the Rafah refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. And one journalist asked the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, why doesn't the quartet do something? And he answered, you would want to see immediate action by the quartet, either to stop the demolition of the houses, and that would take the kind of action and will and resources and confrontation today that, frankly, I don't see anyone in the international community willing to take. What does that mean? It means the UN Secretary General is admitting that the quartet is just a fig leaf, that the sponsors of the so-called peace process, they want a process. They don't care if there's peace or not. They just want a process. Why? Because if you owe someone money and you don't want to pay them, if you can convince them it's on the way, then they'll leave you alone. You know, it's coming. I'll get paid next week and I'll give you the money. I mailed the check. You didn't get it yet? It's on its way. This is what the quartet is. It's a pill to try to keep the Palestinians and to keep the Arab world and the rest of the world calm. Because as long as they can claim there is a process, then they don't have to confront Israel. Because for anybody in today's world who dares to speak against Israel, they really face they pay a political price, or if they're an individual or a student, as we've seen in many places in Canada and in Quebec, they face persecution, targeting, and it's happened here in a way that doesn't happen to students who speak for Israel, even if sometimes when they espouse very racist causes. The roadmap, you'll hear many things about it. All of it is very vague because the peace process sponsors, the peace process industry, as I call it, never give specifics. They just talk about a concept of a Palestinian state without details, because when they get to the details, what you discover is that the 22%, the West Bank and Gaza, which is just 22% of Palestine, is not really on offer to the Palestinians. And really what they're offering the Palestinians is something like 10% of Palestine broken into pieces. And this map shows you here the kinds of plans for a Palestinian state which Israel is talking about. And you see that Palestinians once, in 1948, were the majority in the whole country, and now the international community is talking about a Palestinian state in less than 10% of the country, broken in pieces, completely surrounded by Israel. Now, recently, the former apartheid president of South Africa, F.W. de Klerk, had a look at the roadmap. And this is what he said. This was in the Dutch newspaper Haagse Courant on 16th of October. F.W. de Klerk, who was the president of South Africa, said that as a young politician, he supported apartheid. And he said, the idea was originally sound. It was a good idea.
As a young parliamentarian, I was enthusiastic about forming independent homelands for every group. The Afrikaners, including the Afrikaners, the whites, which would subsequently cooperate in a federation. There was a serious study of 4,000 pages about this in 1954 when the apartheid system was being created. This is what F.W. de Klerk says. The roadmap between Israel and Palestine is based on exactly the same principles. That's the assessment of F.W. de Klerk, who was the president of apartheid South Africa and who was the president who negotiated an end to apartheid with the ANC and Nelson Mandela. So I want to stop with a question, or with a comment and then a question. The comment is that internal resistance has made the occupation and the colonization of the West Bank and Gaza very difficult and expensive for Israel, but it hasn't stopped it. The international community has not only failed to end the Israeli occupation, but is now assisting Israel with this fake peace process, which is giving legitimacy to the occupation and legitimacy to a peace plan which the apartheid president of South Africa identifies as being identical to what South Africa was doing in 1954. But now we're 2004. Many Palestinians are concluding that the possibility of a two-state solution is no longer feasible. Remember last year, President Bush said that we would have a Palestinian state by 2005. But recently he said, well, a Palestinian state is a good goal for the next 4 years. So what will he say in 4 years' time when the pizza is gone? And many Palestinians are reaching the conclusion that it's futile to continue chasing this, that Israel, backed by the United States, now unfortunately backed by Canada, as we saw in the recent vote yesterday in the United Nations, that there's no possibility of ending the occupation and achieving a Palestinian state. And there's more and more discussion of transforming the struggle along the lines of the anti-apartheid struggle and saying, well, we have two peoples, roughly equal in number. It's a very small country. They are intermingled. They live in segregated communities, but these communities are interspersed with each other in a way that you can't separate. And therefore, we should aim to create a single democratic state which offers all Israelis and Palestinians equal rights, equal citizenship. If you want to be a very religious Jew, that's okay. Your right is protected, as it would be in Canada or it would be in the United States. If you want to be a Palestinian, Palestinian nationalist, well, that would be protected. But the idea would be to break radically from this failed concept of a two-state solution. Israel has built this infrastructure for 400,000 settlers, and it's a racist infrastructure. You have to be a Jewish to live in the settlements. Even Israeli citizens who are non-Jews cannot live in the settlements. It's a purely racial definition of citizenship. In a single state, you face the problem of integration, that you have the issue of Palestinians who were deprived, the majority of Palestinians were deprived of their land and property These settlements were built on land which was taken from Palestinians. So in a way, you still have that major problem. But I agree that infrastructure can be used, that the settlements can be integrated, that they provide a basis for Palestinian refugees who wish to return to that part of Palestine to live in them. Similarly, housing settlements inside what is now Israel would have to be open to people of all races. So rather than talking about the removal of 400,000 settlers, which to me, even though those settlers are there illegitimately, illegally, when you start talking about moving 400,000 people, even settlers, to me it also starts to sound inhumane. And I instinctively, legally they have no right to be there, but their children were born there and they didn't ask to be born there. And so for me, I prefer to think of a situation where everybody can live where they want to, as long as they have equal rights, as long as they gain their property legitimately, and there is a proper restitution and compensation for those whose property was taken illegally. I much prefer the idea of Jews living with Palestinians as citizens in Hebron, in Bethlehem, wherever, and Palestinians living in Tel Aviv, in Jaffa, in Petah Tikva. Why not? It's not the end of the world. But this seems to be, to me, a very logical idea, is treated as a catastrophe by many people. And that's something that is a long discussion still. Israelis reject this idea, and they claim anybody who proposes it is trying to destroy Israel. And, well, let's go ahead.
I just wanted to know your position on Sharon's disengagement plan, and since it was accepted by Kofi Annan and George Bush, and the significance of that on the roadmap.
Thank you for asking that question. I was hoping somebody would. Again, I think the position of the international community and the quartet on Sharon's so-called disengagement plan is very revealing. Now, there is no UN resolution which says the Israelis should disengage from the occupied territories. The word disengagement doesn't exist. The word that's used is withdrawal. Se retirer from the occupied territories, which is very clear language. To withdraw means something. The Israelis never use the word to withdraw, withdrawal. They talk about redeployment. I'm not sure what redeployment is in French. I hope the translators do. Okay, redeployment, which is a word that was invented in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Redeployment just means moving things around, not withdrawing. And the latest Israeli word is disengagement. What's disengagement? Désengagement. Okay, it's very easy then. What does disengagement mean? It doesn't mean anything. It means whatever you want it to mean. Now, the proper response of the international community when the Israelis said, we plan to disengage from Gaza, is they should say, no, you have to withdraw from Gaza. But they didn't say that. They said, oh, that's great. And we'll help you. Now, there have been many analyses from within Israel which are very clear what disengagement means in the opinion of Sharon. It means removing the settlers from the heart of Gaza. There are 7,000 settlers in Gaza, but they take up one-third of the land, and Gaza is very tiny. It's just about 20 kilometers by something like 8 kilometers wide. And turning Gaza into a giant prison. And already Palestinians are paying the price of disengagement. And this is why the world is silent about what happened in Rafah and Jabalia, in the past few months, because Israel destroyed thousands of homes, thousands of houses, made thousands of Palestinians homeless to clear a strip around Gaza, literally to cleanse it of Palestinians so that they can surround the Gaza Strip on all sides. Gaza will not have a border with Egypt. The Israelis will be on the border with Egypt. And Gaza will become a giant prison. The Israeli analyst Amir Oren, who writes in Haaretz newspaper, said it will be occupation by remote control. That's the character of the disengagement. What's the political significance of the disengagement? Well, we have the testimony of Sharon's most senior advisor, Dov Weisglass, who in an interview with Haaretz just at the beginning of October, explained the purpose of disengagement. The significance of the disengagement, he said, is the freezing of the peace process. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, and you prevent a discussion on the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem. This whole package called the Palestinian state, with everything that it involves, has been removed from our agenda. And all of this with authority and permission, all with a presidential blessing from President Bush and the ratification of both houses of Congress. The disengagement is actually formaldehyde. It's what they preserve dead bodies with. Lenin is still preserved in formaldehyde after 80 or 90 years. It supplies the amount of formaldehyde necessary so there will not be a political process with the Palestinians. In other words, Israel is trying to use Gaza as leverage in order to keep the West Bank. The West Bank is what Israel really wants. They don't want Gaza because Gaza is a burden. So by creating this prison in Gaza, Sharon wants to say, look, we're not responsible for the 1.5 million Palestinians there. And by the way, we're also not an apartheid state because now those 1.5 million Palestinians are removed from the demographic equation. The shame of it is that the international community is going along with this. And it's our responsibility to expose that and not to allow this to happen. And there are even many liberals and people who claim they're in favor of peace who support the disengagement. And they say disengagement at any price. And it's very important to understand that disengagement does not serve the Palestinians in any way. And hundreds of Palestinians have already paid for it with their lives, with the destruction of Rafah and Jabalia refugee camps in the past few months.
Bonsoir. J'ai deux petites questions à poser. Concernant le conflit religieux, j'ai l'impression que vous avez refusé de donner une connotation religieuse au conflit qui se déroule au Proche-Orient. Pourtant, on trouve bien que même le nom d'Israël, il a une connotation religieuse. Donc pourquoi ne pas utiliser la religion comme une sorte d'idéologie au moins pour motiver les gens d'être plus fidèles? Deuxième petite question concernant l'État binationaliste. Est-ce qu'on a vraiment, les Arabes surtout, est-ce qu'ils ont vraiment un intérêt de vivre avec les Juifs? Surtout si on a remarqué qu'ils ont refusé une sorte de fédéralisme avec la Jordanie. Donc pourquoi on refuse le fédéralisme avec les Jordaniens, on accepte avec les Israéliens?
Qui a refusé?
L'OLP apparemment il a refusé de faire une sorte de fédéralisme avec le roi Hussein. Merci.
The question of religion. Religion has become a part of the conflict now. But at the origin, the Zionist movement was not, it was a movement that used religion in
a way that was quite new at the time. The innovation which Zionism came up with was to say that Jewish people, people of the Jewish faith, and Judaism was practiced by people in all parts of the world. It was practiced by Arabs, by Europeans, by people who spoke French, German, Chinese. It's a religion like Christianity, like Islam. The Zionist movement reformulated Judaism as a nationality so that you can be Jewish by nationality even if you have no religious observance. And so the Zionist movement initially was actually a secular movement. So in this way, it's a contradiction. The founders of the Zionist movement were socialists, and they did not conceive of the Jewish homeland that they wanted to create as a theocratic state, as a Jewish theocratic state. They wanted to create a Jewish nationality, which was an image of other European nationalities, because Zionism came at a time when you had when nationalism was at its height in Europe. So this came just after the unification of Germany in the 1860s under Bismarck, and the unification of Italy. And Zionism was a response also to the persecution of Jews in Europe. So it was a response which said that nationalism is the solution. And when the first Zionist settlers went to Palestine, they didn't go to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is supposedly the spiritual center of Judaism, but they didn't settle in Jerusalem. They founded a new city, Tel Aviv, and other settlements like Petach, Tikva, and Rishon LeZion, which were supposedly modern, industrial, and represented what they called the new Jew. They wanted to convert Jews into an agrarian class and into a working class. And this was the ideas of the time. Religion became important after 1967, when Israel began to assert religious justifications for the occupation of Jerusalem, and to say, Jerusalem is the center of Judaism. We've been yearning to return there for 2,000 years, and our history in Jerusalem is more important than anyone else. The Quran doesn't mention Jerusalem. The Bible, you know, the Torah mentions Jerusalem so many thousands of times. Ridiculous way to approach things, because you can't measure faith by counting words. But when you start to make such a claim, if I say Jerusalem is mine, you'll say, no, it's mine. And it becomes a religious conflict. And that's what happened. Before that, I'll give you an example. In Bethlehem, which is where my father grew up, in a village near Bethlehem. And he went to school in Bethlehem. And next to his school is a very small old building with a dome on it. It's called Rachel's Tomb, or Rachel's Dome. And it has a Muslim cemetery. And since a few years, Jewish settlers said this is holy to Jews. Now, it was there for centuries. Nobody laid a finger on it. Nobody harmed it. The people of Bethlehem, Muslims and Christians, looked after it. And the cemetery was there. Muslims were buried there. Now Israel seized it completely. They said, only Jews can go there. When I went there in 1996, I wasn't allowed in. You had to be Jewish to go there. This creates a reaction. This creates a reaction. When people now say this, they say it's theirs, no, it's ours. They say it's more holy to them, no, it's more holy to us. So it's important to understand that religion was never a factor, that Jews and Muslims and Christians lived in Palestine. And they did not see their religions as a contradiction. And this goes back a long way.
when the Crusaders came from Europe and they kicked Jews out of Jerusalem and Muslims and Christians because they didn't like the Christians they found there. They weren't the right kind of Christians. When Umar reconquered Jerusalem from the Crusaders, he brought the Jews back in. So this now, one of the distortions of Zionism is to propose that there is a contradiction between being Jewish and Arab, or being Jewish and Muslim. And there was never a contradiction because millions of Jews were Arabs. Their native language was Arabic. Their culture was Arabic. But Zionism created this contradiction and it destroyed the Arab-Jewish identity so that Arab Jews were pushed out of Arab countries because of Zionism, or they left Israel, encouraged them to come to Israel. And when they got to Israel, Israel made them lose their Arab identity. And it killed the Arab identity of Jews. So it's important to understand the sanitizing effect of Zionism, that it created contradictions that never existed. I'm sorry to give such a lengthy answer, but you know, if we look at it from the perspective of just 2 or 3 years, it's impossible to see that. You have to go back a long way.
Bonjour, mon nom est Marc. Je travaille pour STHP. Ma question s'adresse au sujet de l'État binational. Je demande si les Palestiniens qui vivent dans les territoires occupés, est-ce qu'ils commencent à considérer cette option? C'est ma question.
Yes, they are considering it, but it's a discussion that is at the beginning. I know you had Michael Tarazi come to Montreal recently, and he wrote, he observed recently that some opinion surveys in the occupied territories say that already 25% of Palestinians support this idea inside the occupied territories. Outside, I think it's much higher. And he writes that this is, he says, recent polls indicate that a quarter of Palestinians favor the secular one-state solution, a surprisingly high number given that it is not officially advocated by any senior Palestinian leader. And so I think it's something that can only grow if we have the discussion, if we start the debate. Because what are the alternatives to it? The alternatives that are being discussed in Israel this apartheid that is being built now, which John Dugard described, or ethnic cleansing. There are parties in Israel that openly say the only solution to the conflict is the physical expulsion of all the Palestinians. Because, so it's a discussion, I predict, that in the next 2 or 3 years, as the dominant two-state solution discourse is exposed as really fraudulent, a cover, process without peace, people are going to start discussing this idea and start accepting it. But you also have the Palestinian Authority, which is very invested in the status quo. And as long as they exist in order to give legitimacy to this process, it's going to be very hard to have a real discussion about it. But it's coming.
Ma question va aller un peu dans le même sens. En fait, c'est des petites questions. J'avais lu à quelque part que lorsqu'il y avait des historiens israéliens qui s'étaient un peu penchés sur l'exode forcé, que ça avait fâché beaucoup de gens en Israël qui n'étaient pas vraiment au courant de ça, qui pensaient que vraiment les Palestiniens étaient partis de par eux-mêmes. Je veux savoir, d'une part, est-ce que les Israéliens sont au courant de la véritable histoire, de ce qui s'est véritablement passé? Je voudrais savoir aussi, est-ce que les colons israéliens qui habitent dans les territoires occupés, est-ce qu'ils savent qu'ils sont à quelque part utilisés? Ou est-ce qu'ils, eux, c'est vraiment par ferveur religieuse? Je sais qu'il y a des incitatifs économiques aussi à aller s'installer dans ces territoires-là. Mais est-ce que ces gens-là se sentent à quelque part, le savent à quelque part, qu'ils sont utilisés par une politique qui est plus en haut? Et c'est ça, c'est un commentaire aussi. Ça, c'est peut-être le commentaire d'une Canadienne. On a beaucoup de la avec ce conflit-là, on a beaucoup de difficultés à comprendre comment des gens qui ont été autant persécutés dans leur comme peuple, comme nation, puissent aujourd'hui persécuter autant. On a tendance à se dire, je me pose la question, est-ce qu'on a besoin de remettre l'histoire sur la table pour les jeunes? Et est-ce qu'on peut tabler sur les jeunes, les nouvelles générations? Est-ce que c'est avec les nouvelles générations que les gens vont être plus tolérants et qui vont davantage travailler ensemble? Et que peut-être finalement les vieilles générations, il n'y a rien à faire avec ça. On peut pas rien faire avec ces gens-là. Parce que si on prend juste l'exemple ici au Québec, ben on le voit qu'avec des générations de les 20 à 30 ans, c'est des gens qui sont beaucoup plus tolérants, beaucoup plus ouverts aux différences. Et finalement, il faut tabler sur les jeunes. Merci.
I think I share your sentiment. And in Palestine in particular, more than half the population, actually 75% of the population is under age 30. What does that mean? And talking about the population in the West Bank and Gaza is that 75% of the population was born under foreign military occupation, that they have no experience whatsoever of a normal life, of freedom, of seeing Israelis as anything other than soldiers and colonists and oppressors. But I think that when I talk to Palestinians, when I talk to my friends, my relatives, to other people, there is an openness. I think Palestinians are less resistant to the idea of living with Israelis than vice versa. And this is surprising given the amount of violence that Palestinians have experienced. The issue of history, I think that the historians you're talking about in Israel did play an important role in making Israelis conscious of the true history of how Israel came to be. You know, traditionally, the debate about Israel and Palestine has followed a certain format. We argue about who was right in history and who was wrong. We say Israel didn't have a right to be there. The Israelis say, no, it did. And probably it's impossible to ever bridge that gap completely. Although in the past 20 years, the Israeli understanding of history and the world's understanding of the history has moved much more towards the narrative and experience that Palestinians have been telling. But in the end, the history actually doesn't matter in this sense. It matters. It's very important to understand the context, but at the same time, let us suppose that 50 years ago, the Israelis were 100% right and the Palestinians were 100% wrong, for the sake of argument. What does it change today? You still have 50% Palestinians, you still have 50% Israelis. They still have to live together. We don't live in a world where we can say that your grandfather made a mistake, so his children and his children's children have to be punished forever. Human rights belong to every human being. Dignity belongs to every human being. So it doesn't matter. If the Palestinians were 100% right and the Israelis were 100% wrong,
Israelis still have a right to live with dignity and security. They don't have the right to do it at the expense of the Palestinians. So I think in a way, if we can accept that, it frees us to look at history more honestly. And that's very important to reconciliation. That's I think, the power of the example in South Africa of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, is that it separated the process of recognizing history from deciding how to solve the political conflict.
I just like to ask a question on now that you have, let's say, an extremely right-wing Foreign Secretary Condoleezza Rice, who I think is almost adamantly, opposed to anything, to the peace prospects. I mean, if you know her history and you know what her background is, she's always been allied with the ultra-right-wing hawks in the United States. Now you have also Paul Wolfowitz, you have Richard Perle, who are also dictating the foreign policy in the United States. Richard Perle himself was an advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu, as you already know. And so the whole idea for at least for the next 4 years, I think that any of these issues of even binational state or whatever are certainly going to be scrapped. They cannot. What you're going to have right now is the implementation of Ariel Sharon's theories, of which is basically a gated community in Israel, a fortress Israel, the way America is building a fortress America or North America, and a fortress Europe, whereby you keep building up all these controls to avoid immigrants or asylum seekers coming into the country. And it's going to be exceptionally difficult to promote a more viable or meaningful peace, especially since now you also have the idea of creating a pro-American Palestinian leadership. I mean, Dahlan has been thrown around, and Dahlan himself has been involved with the MI6. He was located in London for many years, for a particular period, like Hui, who was assassinated in Iraq, the cleric, the Shia cleric who was actually sent in by a CIA airplane, and he was killed in one of the mosques in Baghdad. I think ultimately the issue is going to come down to demographics. I think there isn't going to be any solution in the next 4 years with the type of leadership you have in the United States and what's happening in Israel. I think we're talking about after the next 4 years. And then we're talking about, even long-term-wise, about the demographics. What are the demographics going to do in Israel? There's no more new immigration coming to Israel. That's finished. The reason Ariel Sharon raised anti-Semitism and encouraged French Jews to come into Israel is simply because he's not getting any Russian Jews coming to Israel. And certainly American Jews are not going to go.
Well,
and the other thing I think is that you have this cooperation of CIA, MI6, the Mossad, all trying to control Israel and solidify Ariel Sharon's or the ultra-right wings in Israel, and specifically with the intention of making sure that they're going to secure the oil revenues coming from Iraq, making sure that the Caspian Sea is certainly secure, Azerbaijan, Turkey is also involved. The reason why the Americans are pushing Turkey to join the European Union is simply to make sure that you'll have a London Ankara access.
Let me stop you for a moment.
Yeah.
I think what you're saying is absolutely reasonable, but things don't always go to plan. The Iraq was not supposed to look the way it does. And, the bottom line is this. 5 million Israelis cannot act as the jailers for 5 million or 6 million or 7 million Palestinians. You can build walls around them. They won't accept it. And Israel is reaching a limit of what it can do. Everything Israel has tried has failed. It's absolutely failed. After 60 years, the Palestinian people are absolutely unbroken. I mean, The expectation was that Palestinians would forget, because there was a racist view of Palestinians that one Arab is like any other Arab. So if you kick them out, they'll go and live with the other Arabs and they'll be fine. Didn't happen that way. And you have now new generations of Palestinians in Canada and the United States who are more attached to their rights and to their heritage even than their parents. In many cases, our parents are have given up in a way, and it didn't go to plan. And what I think is so encouraging is that the generation of Palestinians I see do not conceive of the Palestinian struggle as a communal struggle or a tribal struggle, but as a universal struggle, one that has to be based on universal principles. And I think that that is something that can't be defeated by Condoleezza Rice or by walls or by any of that. The walls Israel is building is a last resort. It's an absolute admission of failure. And, you know, you can say Israel is walling the Palestinians in, but it's also walling itself in. And I don't believe that, I agree that, you know, we're not talking about a solution in 4 years. We're certainly not talking about a Palestinian state in 4 years. But I do think that we're at a transitional point where the dominant discourse, the dominant rhetoric has failed. And it has not been replaced with anything else. And it's our job to replace it with a new discussion, one which is based on universal principles, one which challenges the so-called right of Israel to be a racist state, because that's what it is. Israel doesn't grant rights based on citizenship. It grants rights based on ethnicity. And that's unacceptable in the 21st century. There are, within Israel itself, forget about the occupied territories, there are more than 1 million non-Jews who live as second-class citizens. Even if you ignore the West Bank and Gaza, within Israel itself, the situation is untenable. So, I hold sort of a contradictory perspective that on the one hand, the challenge faced by the Palestinians and the forces arrayed against the Palestinians have never been greater. But at the same time, I feel more optimistic than ever that when people say the struggle will take decades and decades, we're at the end of that, in a sense. I'm not trying to be, you know, naive about it, but we've had a struggle of 60 years or 100 years, and it has failed. Zionism failed. You know, I don't think that in 1948... the Israelis imagined that 60 years from now they would be facing a majority of Palestinians in the country. In 1948, there were 200,000-300,000 Palestinians left inside the country. Now there's more than 5 million. And the Israelis are predicting that in 20 years there'll be 9 million and the Israelis will be 6 million. And I'm not even counting the Palestinians outside in Syria and Lebanon and Jordan. So already there are, within Israel and immediately on its borders, 10 million Palestinians and 5 million Israeli Jews. I'm not saying that to say, okay, then you just sit there and let demographics take care of it. 5 million Israeli Jews is a significant number, and they have human rights, and they have a contribution, and we have to offer them an inclusive vision, because they're not going to disappear, and they ought not to disappear. The solution to the injustice of Israel's creation is not to inflict a new injustice on Israelis. It's up to us to learn from the vision of reconciliation which was offered in South Africa. South Africa proves a couple of things: that such reconciliation is possible, but that it is also extremely difficult. It's a very hard struggle. And we're just, I think, at that moment now where we have to start thinking that way.
Bonsoir. Vous avez un peu partiellement répondu à ma question. Et ça concerne surtout la question, la première question concerne le volet démographique, parce que vous avez dit tout à l'heure que la vision de deux peuples, un pays, peut être viable. Mais quand on sait aujourd'hui que les Israéliens font, on peut qualifier ça d'épuration ethnique, pour avoir un pays, surtout avec les Juifs, j'ai du mal à penser un instant que la vision de deux peuples, un pays, puisse être viable dans leur tête, puisque aujourd'hui, on ne peut pas le nier, c'est eux qui sont en position de force dans cette région. Ça, c'est le premier point. Le deuxième, ça concerne le peuple palestinien lui-même, avec la disparition récente de Yasser Arafat. Quand on regarde bien, est-ce que, d'après vous, vous connaissez mieux la région et les hommes qui s'y trouvent, vous ne trouvez pas que le peuple palestinien lui-même risque une explosion interne par le fait qu'il n'y a pas un leader assez charismatique qui puisse contenir tout le monde et tracer une vision pour les décennies qui viennent? Et le troisième commentaire concernera Jérusalem, parce que je crois que dans tous les plans de paix qu'il y a eu, ça a été l'un des problèmes les plus épineux à résoudre. Il y a certaines personnes qui ont proposé de faire de Jérusalem une ville ouverte aux trois religions monothéistes, donc l'islam, le christianisme et le judaïsme. Est-ce que cette avenue ne peut pas être la plus apaisante pour tout ce monde-là? Merci.
The first question you pose, you see it is extremely difficult to imagine Israelis accepting this. That's right. At the moment, most Israelis overwhelmingly reject the idea of a single democratic state. At the same time, there is evidence that such a thing could work. We have to remember that within Israel itself, there are already 1.2 million Israeli citizens who are of Palestinian origin. They're the Palestinians and their descendants who remained behind when Israel was created. And they're citizens of Israel. And they vote in Israeli elections. They are second-class citizens. They're discriminated against systematically. On the other hand, they are, in a way, integrated into Israeli culture. They live in certain cities like Haifa with Israeli neighbors without a problem. I personally met many Palestinian citizens of Israel who work with Israelis, who teach in Israeli universities, who understand that they're second-class citizens. But at the same time, there's a kind of coexistence. It's and this under very imperfect conditions. I think if you created equality, then the coexistence would be even better. So that, in a sense, we can't ignore that, you know, cultural forces exist. Those Palestinians did not ask to be Israeli citizens. Israel was imposed on them. But they have a role in the state of Israel. They vote. They have a political role. They're excluded. They're systematically excluded. But they demonstrate that it's not a ridiculous idea for Palestinians and Israelis to live in the same state, because there are already more than a million Palestinians living as Israeli citizens. What we're talking about is extending that model and redressing the economic, social, and political imbalance so that those resources are redistributed fairly. And I think that for Israelis, there are some Israelis, and I have a lot of examples of that, who believe that God created them as superior to Palestinians and superior to other people. But I think the vast majority of Israelis are motivated by, in a way, by fear, that they cling to power because they can't imagine giving up power. They believe that giving up power is suicide. And they have to be convinced, they have to understand, as I think they will, that the price of keeping a monopoly on power is much greater than giving it up. And that's something I think that they can be made to understand in two ways. And the other day I talked about attention, that we have on the one hand to put pressure on Israel and to put pressure on our governments to put pressure on Israel to end its oppressive policies. On the other hand, we have to articulate an inclusive vision which is attractive to Israelis. Two things which are in a way contradictory, but it can be done. And that was the genius of the anti-apartheid struggle. It was uncompromising on matters of principle, but at the same time, it told whites in South Africa that if you give up power, you will be safe. You will get the kind of acceptance and legitimacy that you can't get through domination. And that's a message which I think Palestinians have never tried to articulate to Israelis. The response to Israeli nationalism and Zionism has been a Palestinian nationalism. And Palestinian nationalism, by definition, can include only Palestinians. So we have to try to reformulate these ideas so that, I don't feel in any way that a binational state threatens my Palestinian culture, heritage, identity, or history. On the contrary, it frees it. It frees it from, it frees me from having to politicize it. It allows me to accept it and explore it and enhance it. And I think the same would be true for Israelis. Their culture doesn't have to be enslaved to political purposes and to an ideology of domination. So I think that's the struggle and discussion we have to have, and to try to engage Israelis in it while at the same time keeping up pressure on Israel. That's very hard to do. Your question about Jerusalem, I believe in an open city for everyone. Separate the issue of religion from Jerusalem as a living city. As a living city with residents, all its residents have to have their rights. But as a religious symbol, it should be open to everyone. Why not?
Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres questions? Permettez-moi de remercier Ali Abou Nu'ma.